This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices All-Stars, episode number 40, was recorded on July 29th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. All-Star Professor Steve Keen is back with us today. This episode of Macro Voices All-Stars is brought to you by TopTradersOnPlug.com, the leading podcast for systematic trading and investing. They're even offering Macro Voices listeners a free book. I'll tell you how to claim it at the end of this episode. Steve, you are generally seen as kind of a permabear on the economy. But right now, a lot of people are calling for a U.S. recession coming soon, except you're not. So what's going on?
Yeah, well, this is, I can actually drag this back to 2000, Eric, because when I started seeing the potential for financial crisis, that was the trigger for me writing Debunking Economics, the first edition. And what I saw happening was that everybody was emulating the same mistake Japan had done, and that was letting private debt get out of control, which when you what you have when the private debt's rising rapidly, you have very high credit, you have a boom out of that. But when the boom, when the rising credit comes to a halt, so does your economy, you have a serious crash. And if you look back at Japan, for example, its level of private debt rose from below 150% back in 1978 to 225% by 1993-94, gave an enormous credit boom. Credit was running at about 30% of GDP in 1990, and then it all came plunging down to the stage where for most of the post 2000 period, credit was negative. In other words, change of debt was negative. People were paying debt off rather than credit adding to demand. It was actually subtracting from demand. And they've been stuck in that situation now for something of the order of 25 years, with finally the private debt level falling down to about 150% of GDP. But it meant a major source of demand for the economy was gone. I had a good old giggle when I saw Ben Bernanke say, this could never happen in the well-regulated and transparent American financial system. Yeah, and pigs might fly too. And of course, it finally happened to America, happened to the UK, Spain, a whole lot of other countries back in 2008. And they're all in the aftermath to a financial crisis. And one of the hallmarks of that is that credit demand is stifled. It never gets back to the same level of rate of growth it had beforehand, which was the situation we saw in Japan. And in America's case, you had a peak of private of credit being 15% of GDP in 2007, fell to minus 5% during the depths of the financial crisis, and that's what actually caused the financial crisis. It's since recovered, courtesy of a lot of government stimulus trying to get people back into borrowing money once more. And there is now a positive credit demand in America, but it's running over the order of about 6% or 7% of GDP, which is not too far above the rate of growth of nominal GDP. And therefore, it's flatlining, and you don't have a lot of demand coming out of it. So demand is fairly anemic. That's my main explanation for why the economy has been so slow for the last 10 years. It's not secular stagnation, as Larry Summers claims. It's credit stagnation. But it also means that if you do have a downturn, your downturn's from a substantially lower level of credit. And it's like it's the difference between jumping off a high cliff and jumping off a small one. With the fallback in 2007, America went from plus 15% of GDP as credit to minus 5%. That's a 20% of GDP turnaround. That's huge. That's what's caused a huge crunch. This time, if you have a slowdown, it's slowing down from about 6% or 7% of GDP. It's not all that much, and you won't have much of a crunch. And again, the UK is in a similar situation. All the countries that had a serious crisis back then are in the same boat. There's a few exceptions, Australia and Canada being two of the most prominent, China, of course, also being a wild card in all this. But apart from those countries, I don't see anybody having a major credit slump. So I don't see the precondition of a boom beforehand to give you a credit crash and a crisis like we saw in 2008.
Okay, Steve, you just gave us quite a smorgasbord of different countries and economies around the world. So if you don't see a recession coming to the United States soon, what about the rest of the world? Do you see risks elsewhere?
Yeah, some countries. I mean, as I said, it's countries which managed to borrow their way through the financial crisis and therefore looked like they were, you know, magnificent financial managers. They're the ones I see being in trouble. So, for example, Norway is one of those countries, even though Norway's got that huge wealth fund and the oil resources and running a trade surplus, et cetera, et cetera. It's continued borrowing right through the financial crisis. It's gone from a debt level of about of the order of 220% of GDP to 260% since the crisis, going up where America's gone down, for example, from 170 to 150. It's strongly reliant upon credit, but credit's falling right now, and the rate of change of credit there is negative. They've certainly had a housing bubble. So I think Norway looks fragile. Another country that's in a similar situation is the Netherlands, which had a gigantic credit bubble that's almost got to the stage of 300% of GDP. This is supported by a huge trade surplus, which is one of, it's one of the beneficiaries of the euro in that sense. But it's got a strong reliance upon credit, and the rate of change of credit is negative, which is one of my precursors for a crisis. So I've seen trouble there. Korea is another one that's looking a bit dicey, not as bad as the others, but it's had a trend of rising debt. It's starting to fall over. And if credit running at 10% of GDP, a fall from there would be problematic for it. France is another one that I have on my radar because, again, France has just continued borrowing right through the financial crisis. It's mainly been the corporate sector. But, again, it's too reliant upon credit, and it relies on this continuing rate of growth of credit being greater than GDP. That just can't keep on happening. So I see it as another one that's potentially in trouble. Denmark is a weirdo. Denmark has been flatlining at 250% of GDP for a long, long time, but I think that's got problems to it. China has had a credit boom and bust, but we all know how much money the government is throwing at the economy as well. So that's counteracting it to some degree. Canada, definitely. Canada has, again, borrowed its way through the boom, still relying upon credit being greater than 10% of GDP, and the rate of change of credit is now negative. So it's another one that I identify. Belgium, strangely enough, has got a huge reliance upon credit right now. Its credits, they're running at over 20% of GDP. Its debt level of the order of 240%. And the rate of change of credit is still positive, but heading down. So that'd be delightful. I'd love to see the capital of the European Union have a credit crunch. It deserves it. And Australia, which has managed to borrow its way. Australia's unique distinction, the reason it's had the world's longest running period of no recession, is because it's had the world's longest period of positive credit right from 1991. And that is finally starting to turn negative again. But that's been controlled by government policy. There is all about keeping the housing bubble going. But those are the countries I'd say that are likely to have a problem. But they don't sum up to anything like the scale of the United States plus UK plus half of the European Union, which is what happened back in 2008.
Okay, so far we've been slicing the global economy according to countries or geographic sectors. What about the financial sector specifically, independent of which nation? A lot of people are getting concerned about the financial sector and its ability to stay competitive.
Yeah, this is my major worry in the whole scene, because I've got a totally accounting-oriented view of the economics now, courtesy of designing my Minsky software. And the essential thing in accounting is what they call the law of accounting: assets minus liabilities equals equity. Now, of course, your asset is somebody else's liability. So if you come up with positive equity, the rest of the world compared to you is in negative equity. And with you look at what institutions in society must maintain positive equity, the answer is the banking sector. If a bank has negative equity, it is bankrupt. It has to fold. That's why I had that hilarious conversation between Paulson and I think the head of Morgan Stanley back during the financial crisis when he told then Treasury Secretary Paulson, you got to do something. You know, we're really on the brink here. And Paulson said, how long have you got? And the answer was about 3 hours. So when you have a plunge in the value of financial assets, then overlevered banks, and of course, virtually all banks were overlevered back then, can go bankrupt almost instantly. Now, because you've had such a boost to the stock market driven by QE, particularly in America, and you've had pretty pathetic corporate returns at the same time, you've got the highest ratio of price to equity in America's history outside two events, 1929 and the 2000 bubble. If you look at Robert Shiller's excellent CAPE index, then the CAPE index in 1929 was 40. It was 48 in 2000. It's currently 36. And that is well beyond any other period in history for America. So you've got this huge overvaluation of American shares, which itself is part of what gives you your liquid financial sector. Now, this is what I think happened back at the end of last year when the Fed decided to go from quantitative easing to quantitative tightening rather than selling, buying bonds off the financial sector, giving them cash, which they were then buying shares, driving up share prices. QT goes in the opposite direction. You sell bonds back to the private financial sector to buy them. They've got to liquidate assets. They sell shares. The share price tanks. Now, given that you've got this anemic returns overall, a very low spread for banks between loan rates and deposit rates, low levels of credit demand anyway, if that happens again, then a lot of financial institutions could suddenly find themselves in negative or approaching negative equity, and bang, we'll have a financial crisis, but not the macro crisis we had back in 2008.
Steve, if I look at the U.S. 10-year Treasury yield, it has collapsed something like 130 basis points from 3.25 or so at the high to below 2% at the very recent trough, and it's bouncing a little bit. Now, even half that much of a move suddenly down, a lot of people would say almost automatically, okay, that's a recession signal. Since you're not seeing this as a recession oncoming, what did that mean? What caused that? And is it over? Are we still headed lower in yield? What's coming next?
I think that's basically the whole trend of central banks. Now, you've got a bunch of people on the deck of the Titanic who think they're driving a Ferris wheel rather than a boat. And what they're doing is just totally messing up the financial sector. You need the old don't fight the Feds become extreme here. And they're just been trying to drive yields down to try to drive the economy up, because the pathetic belief, and from a neoclassical economic point of view, is that you control everything using interest rates. They've pushed them down to as close as they can to zero. We've seen the Fed reversing direction when they tried to put it up recently because the economy started to tank much faster than they expected. They're still ignoring the impact this has on credit and debt. They don't even worry about those issues. So I think this is a continued pressure to try to drive rates down, which they can do indefinitely because they're indefinite capacity to create money, which they then put into the financial sector. So I just see this as, again, more of the impact of Fed meddling. And in this sense, I'm not normally somebody who says abolish the Fed, but I'd like to abolish the people who run the Fed and stop getting these policies that end up putting the financial sector basically on life support to the Federal Reserve.
You know, this is, I think, a very important topic, because a lot of smart people, whether it be Jeff Gundlach or Julian Brigden, who we've had on this program quite a bit, have predicted, okay, at some point we're headed, you know, this is a bond bubble, and we're headed at some point for this bond bubble to burst and for much higher interest rates. But Ray Dalio, who is no schmuck by any stretch of the imagination, has recently opined saying, look, you know, the central banks have the ability, whether you agree with it or not, they have the ability to keep interest rates suppressed for pretty much as long as they want. And why would they, he's talking about the entire next decade, he's saying, why would they allow interest rates to go materially higher given all of the things that they're fighting and the way that they think? What do you think of that, Steve?
Yeah, I'm totally on Ray's side here. Because again, my Minsky analysis of the financial crisis just showed a trend towards deflation and a trend towards very low interest rates. While you've got these high levels of private debt, there's just no possibility for the Federal Reserve to put up rates without causing a crunch, which, of course, they're supposed to prevent. So when they start doing, they go into reverse again. That's why when the Fed started talking about putting rates up and started doing it a couple of years ago, I was saying, here we go, turning Japanese. They'll whack up the rates. They'll slow the economy down. They're forced to go back in reverse direction again. So what's happening right now doesn't surprise me at all. And so long as they continue ignoring the cause, you know, we also always talk about the old expression, the elephant in the living room. This is the elephant sitting on the guests in the living room with too much private debt. Financial sector, the Fed Reserve can't even see the elephant, and they expect the people to be able to cope as they, you know, put pressure on top of the elephant without realizing that they're doing it. So until they get rid of the level of high levels of private debt, we're not going to see rising interest rates.
Well, how does that resolve itself with what seems to me like an inevitable pension crisis? There's no magic here. If you're going to steal from somebody to give money to somebody else, you're stealing from savers and investors. And that means that anybody that is counting on pension income, and that's the whole baby boomer generation, basically, it seems to me like they get screwed out of this deal. And it sets up a great big social problem, which I know you are a fan of MMT. I mean, is that where we're headed, to where we get very low interest rates that result in a pension crisis, which we then try to bail ourselves out of by just monetizing it?
I think the MMT could monetize. You know, it's an MMT philosophy says you could monetize that. You could give the people the pensions they need, because that what that entails is the treasuries, the politicians, have to agree to running deficits. Now, of course, you know, in an accounting sense, I see MMT as being utterly correct in the accounting as how money is created, and then the constraints on the government and so on. But if you have politicians imposing these constraints and not wanting to lift them, then when it reaches that stage, they won't fund the pensions adequately. The only way pensioners are going to make any potential cash, not cash flow, but cash to survive their retirements, is by selling shares. That's if they're out of their 401k schemes and everything else, as well as personal holdings. And you're going to have an immiserated working class and middle class that don't have all many shares to do that in the first place. So you've got huge social problems coming out of this, and it's all a you know, I'd retrace it back to letting private debt get out of control, not realizing you have to keep private debt at low levels, worrying about government debt rather than private debt, and letting this problem develop and then not knowing what the hell to do with it.
Steve, we're going to have to leave it there in the interest of time, but we look forward to getting you back on the show in a couple of weeks for another update. Today's All-Stars episode was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. If you want a different perspective on how to invest in today's markets without emotions and without predictions, go to toptradersunplugged.com/macro, where you can claim a free book about a highly dependable and consistent, yet frequently overlooked investment strategy. Check them out. You'll be glad you did. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. Also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.